the people pretty much behind King Kong, and then Mighty Joe Young was nothing more than an exploitation of what had been done with stop motion to begin with, making a big ape out of stuff. And that's where Ray Harry... And there is this era, there is this moment in time when you had these three guys from L.A. You had Ray Bradbury, Ray Harryhausen, and Forrest J. Ackerman, all living within, like, this small area from each other, all being fans of the same kind of thing, all people who lived into their 90s. And this was a trio. And Harryhausen was the third of the trio, and he died, for those who don't know, 2 days ago. And they were all
92
years old. Bradbury was 91. Forry Ackerman, I think. Oh, Forry was young. He was like 89 or something.
Yeah, that was several years ago, though, wasn't it?
He was a bit older than the others. And but they were pretty much a trio of people, always trying to help out Forry, who somehow was always going broke in different ways, and having to, so, you know, Harryhausen would say, oh, well, you know, here's like a, you know, a skeleton from Sinbad, right. Sell that, and, you know, you can keep your house for another 2 years.
And please, the Acker Mansion, that's no house, that's a museum.
It really is, it really is. And but, you know, one thing to hold against Forrest J. Ackerman, if you're a snob purist like I am,
coining the term sci-fi?
That's it. That's it. Is that... No, he did it right. He did it absolutely right. When Forry Ackerman... Harryhausen was the only one of the three I never met. Forry Ackerman, it was impossible not to meet if you ever went to science fiction conventions. And Bradbury was here at WBAI, of course, actually through the auspices of Matthew Finch, of all people. But anyway, but I got to, as you know, that's a long story. Max rescued that interview. It's an amazing story. But at any rate, what was I talking about? I'm sleepy.
I interrupted you to throw in about Ray Harryhausen.
Sci-fi.
You had the review of Iron Man.
Yes, we do have a review from Cine. Well, from the man who was Cine Fantastique, Dan Persons.
Somewhere I have a box with most of those magazines, although the back issues.
Well, Dan will be here.
Expensive.
Dan will be here in a few weeks to pitch with me,
yeah.
And he will autograph them for you.
Well, I have to go get them out of storage
or
to do that.
Oh well, okay. well, we'll put him into storage. He'll like that. But anyway, the Forry Ackerman story was that Forry was the editor, creator, and editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland, and he specifically coined the term sci-fi to refer to the monster movies of the 1950s.
Right.
And he had a great respect and love for the pulp magazines and the science fiction and the fantasy. And so when I get snooty and say, no, you know, that isn't sci-fi, that's science fiction, I am using Forry Ackerman's definition. Forry agreed that sci-fi was definitely not a different genre, but a sub letting, as it were, of what Robert Heinlein called speculative fiction. That's another one. Is I love the fact that the literary people. I just did a wonderful interview this week, by the way, with a literary science fiction writer, and I will be playing that soon. And they call the literary science fiction speculative fiction because that allows for all of it, and they go, oh, yes, this is a new term that denotes greater literary stuff, except that one finds out that in 1946, Robert Anson Heinlein coined that term in Astounding, and then it's about, you know, 6 years later that Forry Ackerman comes up with sci-fi. So guess what, gang? It's the other way around. Speculative fiction referred to science fiction. Sci-fi referred to monster movies.
Yeah, makes sense. Say, did you see that ad with the page about the werewolf on the plane?
No.
Oh, yesterday is what, either Metro or AM New York. They're really pushing this new book, Red Harvest, or Red, I don't know.
By?
God. Well, his handsome picture was plastered all over the ad, and he appeared somewhere yesterday signing the book. It's actually a very pulse-pounding page of literature.
Wow, wow.
Made me want to run out.
Well, they haven't. I'm still trying to gear up for
Nouveau werewolf literature, apparently.
Okay.
Werewolf on a plane.
So zombies are already...
Don't tell me nothing about no mofo werewolf on this mofo plane.
And his hair was perfect. So zombies are already passé before World War Z opens up?
Passé? Maybe they're just stepping aside a bit.
Maybe so. Or shambling aside. As the case may be, but you know the zombies are the current wave between The Walking Dead and World War Z, about to open any time now, based on the novel by Max Brooks. They even put out a new they upgraded from a reading of the audiobook to a full fledged audio drama, 6-hour audio drama, which I just got in the mail of World War Z. One of these days, I'll read the book.
Oh, it's a book? It's not a graphic novel?
No, it's not.
Isn't
a graphic novel.
Is
everything
based on graphic novels these days?
Well, movies, usually, yeah, because that way they don't have to spend money
no storyboards.
On... Exactly, exactly, on storyboards.
I will see if I have that paper with that...
Yeah, you do that. But the best commercial, I showed it to you earlier.
Yes.
The best new commercial is an it's an Audi commercial. It's a car commercial. And let's just say, go to YouTube or wherever and type in, do a search on Audi, A-U-D-I, and add to that Spock. That should be enough. It's a 2.5-minute commercial, but by the time it's done, you will have more than one Spock to deal with, and hobbits, and so many fanish jokes that one can put into a single commercial as to be absolutely wonderful and funny. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, and guess what? It's fundraising time. How do we know that? Because it's WBAI in New York City. And we're always fundraising. But the last time we were doing this was out of utter desperation. It was not that we're not in despair right now. We are. In all seriousness, we are. But at that point, it was, we had lost our studios, we were about to be evicted from the Empire State Building and all that. Right now, it's that we haven't paid the paid staff. Now, I'm unpaid staff, but I am not immune to the idea that they haven't been paid. But you see, there are rumors afoot, rumors of rumors that we are looking for a new world. We are looking for a new place. We are in a new place right now, but it's borrowed space up here in Harlem at CCNY, sharing space with under the auspices of WHCR, which is very good and very kind. But WBAI, if we are to survive, which is a question, if we are to survive, we need to find a home. And, well, first of all, we have to do two things. Number one, we have to pay we paid the back rent on the transmitter. We still owe rent on the place that we vacated, 120 Wall Street. We came to some kind of a leasing or long-term agreement on that. And next, after that, we have to deal with, oh, guess what? It's May. It's a new month. That's another $50,000 for the Empire State Building. And that's one piece of rent that cannot be renegotiated. If anything, that's going to go up. So we need to pay that. And, oh, yes, oh, my, we need to pay our staff. And in order to pay our staff, well, such is listener-sponsored radio. But the director of Pacifica Radio is somebody who, I don't say this often about directors of Pacifica Radio, but somebody who I really respect, who I think if anybody can get us out of trouble, it is probably this woman, Summer Reese. She seems to have something on the ball. She's a realtor. And a realtor, perhaps with a sense of reality. Her idea is that WBAI, I don't know how much of this is public, but it will be after I say it. WBAI needs to buy its next home. Oh, well, Robert and I were talking about this earlier. Now, we did own a place in the late 70s, and we lost it through our own internal politics in the late 70s, when I was speaking to Summer the one time that I met her, she said exactly what was paid for it, and I told her the answer, and she basically said what I was been saying all these years is, there was dirty work at the crossroads. But she has this idea that we ought to be able to somehow buy a building. And that is such a correct thinking idea. But that's still a long way away, except for the fact that the rumor is that such a building has been found. But to get into that building, I mean, that's, you know, that's not going to happen this year. I don't know if it's going to happen next year. But what we do have to do is survive in order for that to occur, in order for us to get to a new WBAI. And in order to get into that new WBAI, we must survive, which is why we ask you to call area code 516-620-3602 to make a pledge. Again, 516-620-3602. $25 will make you a subscriber. If you're an old-time listener, pledge $45, because that's what the subscription rate used to be. It went down in the early 80s. I do not understand why the rate went down. I don't understand, frankly, why we're not raising it. So let's theoretically raise it for the duration of this program. $45 pledges. Yeah, that's the ticket. Or if you want to mourn with me, celebrate or mourn the number of years that I've been working here at WBAI, I began working May 1st, 1967, was the first time that I came in to answer telephones and began volunteering at the station. So if we do the math, that means that I am in my 47th year of working here. So $46 between the $45 subscription rate that it used to be and the 47th year that I am working here. How about a $46 pledge? 516-620-3602. Okay, now, before it gets too late, I do want to play the Iron Man review so that people get a chance to hear it before it gets... I'm very pleased that Dan Persons is recording these for us. Let's see. Ah, and here it is. So I haven't even heard it yet. And Nor have I seen the movie, but we'll hear about it together.
Hour of the Wolf, air date, May 9th, 2013, Iron Man 3, take one.
I told you it wasn't edited.
Hey, I'm Dan Persons, your old friend from CFQOnline.com. Why haven't you written? So, we are talking about Iron Man 3 here, and I'll say it. The Iron Man franchise is possibly the snarkiest superhero franchise around. It was born that way. It's genetically coded into the DNA of star Robert Downey Jr. and director Jon Favreau, who did the first two films. This one, the directing and writing has been taken over by Shane Black, who's no stranger to ironic genre himself, having done stuff like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which also starred Robert Downey Jr. on the plus side, and Last Action Hero on the not-so-plus side. But to be fair, he only wrote that film, so there may have been slips past his control. Let's hope so. Here, though, with Iron Man 3, he hits the mark and does it quite nicely. The plot itself is at once very simple and completely chaotic. There's a terrorist staging bombing attacks on U.S. citizens. He's called the Mandarin, and he's played by Ben Kingsley with a Bin Laden beard and, weirdly, an accent that oscillates between Baptist preacher and Hugo Weaving as Agent Smith in The Matrix. He is a classic Iron Man villain. I can't attest to that myself. I'm a DC guy. But that we've got him is, of course, not enough. Into that are thrown a couple of maybe-good, maybe-evil scientists played by Guy Pearce and Rebecca Hall. There's a political conspiracy, a whole lot of kidnappings, and just for fun, a taciturn little boy played by Ty Simpkins, just to give Tony Stark, Iron Man's alter ego, someone to lovingly snipe at. With all of that, there's hardly enough room for Robert Downey Jr. to do his thing as Iron Man, or Don Cheadle to back him up as War Machine, here pointedly redubbed Iron Patriot by the government. But that's really the point. You know, you go to see a Superman film to see Superman, you go to a Batman film to see Batman, although somebody should have told Chris Nolan that with the last film. But you go to an Iron Man film to see Tony Stark, the man inside the armor, and as portrayed by Downey, possibly the most lovable genius billionaire industrialist jerk ever. Now, the preceding film, Iron Man 2, wasn't particularly successful in finding the balance between letting Downey do his thing and serving up the superhero stuff that the people are paying their money for. But Shane Black does much better here. He's found ways of maintaining Downey's presence in the film, even when the special effects kick in, including retooling the Iron Man suit to a kind of easy-in, easy-out mechanism that allows Stark to pop out at will, and also having the suit assemble on Stark piece by piece, frequently stopping the process halfway, all the better to keep the actor on screen longer. More, as is Shane Black's wont, he sculpted this third installment as an ironic subversion of the whole superhero form, most specifically Chris Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, and most specifically the actual Dark Knight film itself. On top of Stark's ongoing crisis of confidence as a superhero, not helped by events he experienced in the Avengers, he really is Bruce Wayne's flip side. Iron Man 3 calls into question what audiences seek from the whole superhero-supervillain dynamic and sneaks in some pointed observations about the whole notion of a war on terror to boot. It's not deep-think stuff. Nolan is still more daring in that regard. But it does bring some bite to the comic book action, and it is appreciated. Comic book purists have been grumbling over the treatment of the Mandarin here. I can't go into detail about that because it is a major plot point. But for me, Iron Man 3 was fun, funny, action-packed, occasionally managed to touch on a genuine human emotion, and still boasts all the big-budget candy that may yet signal the end of Western civilization as we know it. But hopefully that's not going to happen anytime soon, because I did like this film. A lot. I'm Dan Persons. Come listen in as I talk with the makers and stars of new and classic genre film and TV on the CFQ Interview Podcast, available every week at cfqonline.com.
Well, now I get to give directors' notes, producers' notes, as it were. Because I hadn't listened to it earlier, as I promised that I would. And Dan was concerned that he was reading too fast. And no, he wasn't. I thought that pace was good. But, there's a noise in the background there that's even worse than the noise in the background here. That wasn't in his first review. So it sounded like the fan of a computer, whereas we just wanted to hear the voice of, well, the fan. Talking about the movie. So Dan is actually going to be here in a few weeks to talk summer movies and pitch with me. So we can talk about that some more then. And there we'll only have the sound that we've got with us at this point. But again, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And apparently, we have a webcam on Ustream. If you go to Ustream and you type in WBAI, you get this rather not very fluid look at the studio. So you can actually look at me. I'm not sure about that. I wouldn't mind it at all. I just think that we need a better webcam. Personally, I'm addicted to a couple of webcams that I watch on an almost daily basis that I urge you to also. Go to Cornell Lab Ornithology website and look at their nest cams. Right now, there's a couple of red-tailed hawks that have two chicks that are amazing to watch, and there's also a pair of blue herons, but they have three eggs that are due to hatch in about a week. I'm not making this up, you know. And I got to tell you, put on some good music in the background, you put up that webcam on the TV, and you've got a great night of entertainment ahead of you. And you get to talk to those who you live with and things like that. It's a good thing to do. There's also a very good hummingbird live webcam. That's actually year-round. A Phoebe Allen hummingbird. Amazing to watch. But now, there's the WBAI webcam. Also on Ustream. Something I know Mike Sargent has been doing for a while, and I suspect has set this up. Yeah, I'm looking at the camera now. Robert pulled the shade down on it, but the veil has lifted. So if anybody wants to look at that, you are welcome to. I am, by the way, willing to take on-air phone calls if you want to talk about WBAI, its history, and or science fiction and fantasy. In general, the telephone number here on air is 212-650-5782, but I cannot stress too much about that other phone number, 516-620-3602, because our survival, as always, it would seem, is at stake. So, 516-620-3602. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert. Are you my only caller?
I don't know, but I don't feel guilty because I've already made my earlier pledge, and a substantial one at that.
Okay.
Interesting that you mentioned bird websites.
Well, webcams.
Webcams.
Yes, there are a lot of bird websites. These are webcams.
What is a webcam, please?
A webcam is a camera on the web.
Oh, okay. And you mentioned interesting background music while you're watching this. Well, the first piece that I would recommend to you is a piece that you may be familiar with.
Well, I put on actually either WBAI or more often I put on Radio Dismuke.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to mention Ralph Vaughan Williams' wonderful tone.
Rafe Vaughan Williams.
Rafe. I've heard Ralph, but okay.
Yeah, but then you would be wrong.
Okay. Okay.
Because I met his wife.
Okay.
And she said Rafe. And okay. I think that if she had said the wrong name, she might have been corrected. So it was Rafe Vaughn Williams. Yeah. In fact, I'll tell an old BAI story on that. Somewhere in the early 1970s, we had a traffic director when we actually had a traffic department. And he was a classical music more than buff, an expert. And very snooty about it, to the point where he eventually became a WQXR announcer. His name was Frank Coffey. We've had two BAI people get to QXR. But this was Frank Coffey. And one time I was playing Sinfonia Antarctica by Rafe Vaughn Williams. Yeah. And I outroed it at saying Rafe Vaughn Williams. And he was... He didn't think a lot of me. I was, you know, like 16, 17 years old, and he thought that I was making fun, except that I had heard Mrs. Vaughn Williams not long after Rafe Vaughn Williams' death on WQXR with a gentleman by the name of Robert Kraft, who is Vaughn Williams' biographer, and then she came to WBAI. And I got to engineer the two of them. So I knew I was pronouncing it correctly. And I got to lord the correct... he was chiding me, but I had it correct, damn it.
Okay.
So well, it's Rafe Vaughn Williams.
It is Rafe. Rafe, of course, in another constance, in another sense, is a very popular, very common name in the Appalachians. Many, many families... males named Rafe. Interestingly, it comes from the Hebrew name Rapha. And in the Old Testament, Rapha was the son of Goliath. In the book of Exodus, I believe, is where his story is told. But
I wouldn't know.
Rafe Vaughn Williams, for anyone who may not be familiar, the perfect proof of how you can have interlocking cross genres of music.
Okay. Why? Because of themes by Thomas Tallis? Is Greensleeves? What are you referring to? Whoop, oh, I turned down the wrong pot. I'm sorry. Repeat that.
Oh, he has a piece called the Folk Song Suite, which consists of a number of traditional songs such as Lovely Joan, Greensleeves.
Yeah.
And others. But that's that. Thomas Tallis is a different piece of music.
Actually, though, it's usually on this. When one used to discuss albums, they were on the same album.
Oh, yes. No, that's true. And on that,
People may not know my dark side, but I actually know a wee bit about classical music.
You have a dark side, James? I couldn't imagine that. Oh, no. Listen, you have a musical... I have to say this.
I worked for you. My first major job at WBAI, they were twofold. One was, working in the D&L department with Baird Searles, but that was maybe for 3 or 4 years. But then for well over 10 years, I worked in the music department.
Oh, okay. Well, I
worked and I did a morning music program, I did a weekly classical music program. And the two awards that I got for radio are both for music shows, classical music shows, and, of course, my work with Peter Schickele.
Oh, of course, Mr. Schickele. But, of course, I have to say this and give you a compliment. I think, in a way, your musical your strength is that you cover a lot of different things. You're just as comfortable covering jazz classics of the 20s. And, I wanted to...
Basically, I like any music that one can hum. If it has to be spoken, then I consider that poetry and out of my realm.
You know, until you played Jazz Vampire, I had never heard of that piece.
That's a great song. Marion Harris.
Who's the singer again?
Marion Harris.
Okay. I don't... whatever.
She's one of the greats.
By the way, generally, quickly, what do you think of the Great Gatsby movie?
Well, I have to say that I am not fond of what I have heard. I don't like the idea of the soundtrack.
I was going to ask you, do they do period music or not?
No, they don't.
Oh.
That's the problem. If it were period, I don't mind the idea that it's being done by Jay-Z and Beyonce and people like that, but they should be doing covers. I mean, I didn't mind when De Lovely had modern people, Alanis Morissette and Elvis Costello and people like that, but they were doing the songs of Cole Porter.
Ooh.
What they're doing in The Great Gatsby is mostly modern music, which is typical of Baz Luhrmann with his love of anachronism. And if you're doing a movie that could, you know, be even more easily entitled The Jazz Age than The Great Gatsby, then I think you ought to have jazz in it.
Let me ask you a question on that subject in general. If one is watching, or if one is doing a movie that's set in a particular period, i.e., say, medieval Renaissance, something of the Lady Hawk type movie.
The soundtrack of Lady Hawk is one of the worst soundtracks ever.
I totally agree with you. But let me ask you, do you think that it enhances the movie if they use period music in it?
No, it depends on the mise-en-scene of the film itself. I that's not an easy question to answer. It depends on the movie. I think that it can be perfectly fine to move outside the comfort level of the era.
So if you're doing, for example, when I was thinking,
but it depends on the view of the film, and if a movie is about the jazz era, then then it should be the jazz era.
So if, for example, the TV series, you would have no objection if they, and I haven't seen any of this yet, but I intend to, the Borgias, you would have no objection if they did non-period music.
I would have no objections to it, but I wouldn't watch the Borgias if you paid me. But outside of that.
Okay. All right, well, you may have other callers, and it is late.
Okay.
By the way, congratulations. You had two superbly excellent readers last night.
Yes, yeah. The reading, the New York Review of Science Fiction reading last night was pretty darn good, and Ron Hogan was the one who put that together.
Anyway, we will see you soon.
Okay, very good. Take care. And, we seem to have, one working phone line in this place. So if anybody else is calling to talk on the air, the number is 212-650-5782. Sorry, 650-5782. And of course, to keep the station on the air so that you can call that other number, you need to call 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602 is the number to call to pledge to WBAI. We are not going to be pitching premiums this morning. We are not going to be, there will be a premium at some point, but it will not get you, we're looking for $25 or $45 pitches this morning. When we have premiums, entry level to get a premium will be more dear than that. So right now, what the premium, as I was talking about with Robert earlier, the premium itself is the WBAI, the fact that we exist and the continuance of the station itself, the hopeful, our hope that continuance will be there, is totally dependent on your pledge. Again, 516-620-3602. And if you wish to speak on the air about, I'm opening up discussion more or less free form, 212-650-5782. So, no calls at the moment, and I still don't know how to find out if people are responding to the pledges. But do let me say, this is WBAI New York, in New York City here. It is 201. I know that we have people listening around the world by courtesy of the internet, and even by courtesy of the webcam, watching from around the world. So why not? If you're outside of New York City, why not call and make a pledge? That would be novel. That would be a good thing, to specifically try to reach people from outside of New York. Okay, so speaking a little bit of anachronisms and stuff like that, let's play some music that's about, well, people who need money, although it's a modern album. This is Janet Klein's Scandals. Okay, let me try that again. This time I'll bring up the correct pot. Take that back a little. What, Max? You actually have some information? No, he doesn't. He's just looking in to see what it is I'm doing, or to find out what Janet Klein looks like. Well, let's try that again.
When we were young, but old enough for us to understand, we all believed in fairies and hoped in fairyland. But the modern child is running wild, wants to know too much. He's never understood about Red Riding Hood.
How could Red Riding Hood have been so very good and still keep the wolf from the door? That's the question. Father and mother, she had none. So where in the hell did the money come from? Please let me ask it, who filled her basket? The storybooks, they never tell, so tell me, Janet.
Now they say she found a great big wolf in Granny's bed.
Really?
And he had a big sunbonnet pulled down over his head.
Amazing.
But you know, and I know what she must have found instead. How could Red Riding Hood have been so very good and still keep the wolf from the door?
Tell me more now.
Could Red Riding Hood have been so very good and still keep the wolf from the door?
I don't know.
Why was she dressed up in that bright flaming red?
Why was she?
Lest she expected to knock someone
dead.
Oh,
I know that kind of baby.
What did she ramble? She knew it was a gamble. She was out in the woods for no good.
No good at all.
They say she was a maid.
Maid?
Most discreet.
That's pretty rare.
No doubt about it, she must have been sweet.
But you know, and I know
that even sweet girls must eat.
Oh, how could Red Riding Hood have been so very good and still keep that wolf from the door?
Thank you.
Don Redman and his orchestra, along with Helen. Now, actually, that was probably Mae Questel. You know, which Betty Boop are we referring to? Originally, of course, Helen Kane was Betty Boop, and Betty Boop was modeled after Helen Kane, but the Fleischers didn't appreciate Ms. Kane's desire for getting what she felt she was worth. And of course, she was a huge star at that time. So, one second, I'm looking at multiple things on my two computers and other stuff here. There we go. Okay. Thought I'd try to bring up the webcam myself. Nope, package file is invalid, whatever that means. Okay. So much for the tablet. It's all Wi-Fi dependent. And the WBAI Wi-Fi is down. So, anyway, that would have been Mae Questel, but with the Don Redman Orchestra, taken right out of the Max Fleischer cartoon Hell's Bells, starring Betty Boop, whoever was voicing her that week. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored radio at 99.5 FM. I am curious to see if there's more than one person. Since we have moved here to our Uptown facilities, that's Uptown with a capital U, I think I've only gotten one person who has ever called, and I'm interested in hearing from other people, finding out, are you out there? The number to call to speak on the air, 212-650-5782. And this being a fundraising morning program, I'm leaving the topic relatively loose, relatively open. Something I tend not to do when I have guests. Oh, look at that. Two calls coming in. Amazing. And by the way, if it goes into voicemail, just call back. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Hi there. How are you?
Yeah, fine. You know, I've been listening to the problems with the flooding at Wall Street, and you guys really should be on the list for having lost revenue and having had to pay rent when your phone system wrecked your adding, and plus that was a non-profit building, and now it's a for-profit building. But they said that the people who didn't get...
It's still primarily a non-profit building.
...should be getting money back because you lost your own revenue, and instead... You guys are not taking on the company. You're not doing what all those Wall Street people need is to have real barriers, not what they're doing now, because that is still near the water.
And also my understanding, I'm not sure of the update of this, but my understanding is that we also never got paid by our insurance company. And if we have gotten paid, it's only recently. But no, we also, any number of downtown businesses that lost revenue, whether commercial businesses or not, we have not gotten benefit of that. Yes, we should. You're absolutely right.
I think so.
Oh, I know you're right.
I think it's terrible. And also... it was after 9/11 that the only left transmission tower was the Empire State Building. So why should they be charging so much just because they're the only player until buildings are going to have towers, right? Buildings going up down there?
Well, you have to remember that we are a commercially licensed station.
Right.
Okay, we are 99.5 FM.
Right.
And in the middle of the FM dial,
right,
we are technically, we operate as a nonprofit. and we are a listener-sponsored station. But as far as the FCC is concerned, we are a commercial station. And as far as the Empire State Building is concerned,
well, why can't we're a commercial station.
I'm sorry?
Why do we have to be a nonprofit?
We have to be a nonprofit because that is what Pacifica is.
Oh.
I mean, the whole premise of Pacifica, we invented the concept of listener sponsorship. You have to understand that all these places like NPR and PBS and all that are using the concept that was created by Lou Hill, who founded Pacifica in the post-World War II.
And they're corporate funded.
No, we're not corporate funded.
They
very often are corporate funded. But you see, they pay, in my opinion, they pay a price for that.
Oh.
And the price that they pay for that is self-censorship.
Yeah.
Not censorship, self-censorship.
Yeah.
If you, and this was an issue that was brought around for years in Pacifica Radio. There has always been, as long as I've worked here, and I've worked here since 1967, there has always been the argument, why is it that we can't take underwriting grants? And the answer for that is, if somebody holds up a carrot on a stick and says, if you do this radio program, if you cover this topic, you can have that carrot. And if somebody else says, no, I'm sorry, all I've got is, you know, the appreciation of the listeners, because this is the more important topic, any producer is going to say, you know what, I'm going to get better resources by taking that carrot on the stick.
Yeah.
You see, so it's not even an evil thing, and it's not even necessarily a self-censorship thing. It becomes an institutionalized thing that if you are taking corporate underwriting or grants, people paying for salaries, we accept a certain, a very, very limited amount of support from, for example, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, where they help out negotiate paying for the music that we play on the air. You know, every time you play a song, it costs money. This does not come free.
Right.
CPB negotiates rates.
Right.
And they help in that. But we are still over 90% listener sponsored.
Mm.
Now, if somebody came along and said, you know, yeah, that was a very interesting program that you folks broadcast about fracking last year. But you know what? If you were to do a program about all other alternate energy programs, like let's say solar energy, that is sponsored by, you know, the Solar Energy Friends of Upstate Wisconsin, then we would help fund that program. All of a sudden, that program is more likely to get made than the one about fracking.
Yeah.
And it's not because the people are any less politically giving in. It's because it's easier. It's not because their pockets are going to be lined. It's because the funding is there to do what it is that one believes in.
Right.
And then only later do you realize that the people that own the non-existent, I have to be very careful and say I'm, you know, that I'm making this stuff up about, you know, solar wind corporations, although there have been some scandals about that, as a matter of fact.
We're using it requires a lot of water.
Well, it's not just that. It's a question of who owns some of those companies. There really are questions of I have to be careful here because I'm not a public affairs person. I don't keep my ear to the ground the way somebody like Robert Knight does. But there
he was amazing tonight.
He's always on.
Oh.
And let me tell you, he was amazing tonight, and this is after having worked all day, and he has to come back in the morning to produce tomorrow afternoon's show.
That's
so
be bad, and we get worn out, and the freshest people... We can't have that happen.
Yeah, that truly.
I would definitely have someone in charge of the welfare of our best people and not let them be, find a way to get around that.
Yeah.
Why does he have to be in the morning if he's all tired out?
Well, because he has to produce 5 o'clock shadow. And by the way, I would say that he gets paid for that, except for the fact that right now nobody's getting paid.
Well, that has to change. We have to do... There's a lot of changes we're going to... Well, I just see...
There have to be changes. There's no question.
Yeah,
we cannot survive... But you see, I have a personal belief, and that is that the premise of listener sponsorship is still a good premise, and that the evils of grants are still, in fact, evil.
Where it doesn't work, Jim, in a big city like New York, because we are outnumbered by the moneyed people. We have to join in and having more cash or more things we can use to help ourselves.
Now, absolutely. But what we need to be doing is we need to be looking for different routes of revenues, more benefits. We used to have the WBAI Crafts Fair, which brought in a couple of $100,000 every year. We used to have more community events that, even though they themselves did not bring in money, what they did was, to use corporate language, deepened the relationship between this institution and our customers, or that is to say the listener. I believe it or not, once upon a time, I lived in corporate America. I worked for Citibank. I was a network manager. Now, and we were good people, let me tell you.
A long time ago.
No, this was in the 80s. This was in the 80s, and we were interface designers. We worked on making technology simple to use. We were an elite group of about 30 people, and we had a lot of fun, and we were an extremely liberal group of people working for what was at that time a liberal institution, believe it or not.
Yeah.
But at any rate, we would talk about the idea of making an ATM easier to use, because by being attractive to a Citibank, never charged less than other banks on certain things. In fact, they could sometimes charge more. But the theory, and this is, I'm talking about just the era in which I was there, the theory was that if you got people happier with the services that were provided, they would be willing to pay more. Well, that's, I believe, just as true with listener-sponsored radio. If we provide more services, more community events, concerts, town hall meetings, things like that, then when we come on the air and beg people to call 516-620-3602, they're more likely to do it.
Also, Jim, here's an idea. What if our constituencies could have their independence? Because we can't all agree politically.
Oh, why? God, no. when I started working at WBAI, there were some very literal, free thinking conservative parts of the station. William F. Buckley worked here.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, we need to reach out to that, but the idea of Pacifica and listener sponsorship was not only to be progressive, although the word progressive is very...
Because you have to have these different constituencies, and we shouldn't have to have a war over it. There should be a way to manage these different political groupies, well, groups.
Yeah.
I shouldn't call them groupies.
Well, I was saying this before. I was alluding to this with Robert, who I think does not necessarily fully agree with my position. But I have a theory about one of the things. Everybody has their theory of what's wrong with WBAI.
Because a lot of things are wrong.
A lot of things are wrong, but you want to hear mine?
Right.
You want to hear my main theory? My main theory of what became of WBAI and where a lot of it went wrong is that I believe, and this is less true now than it used to be, but I believe that the political elements got rid of the arts elements.
Yeah.
I believe that arts programming is very often political and that arts embraces politics.
Yeah.
But I do not believe that politics embrace the arts.
That's what we have to, you have to make these separations the way we're doing in our government. Look at all the mess we are. We have a person like that guy down in Virginia, was it? The one that was voted in and won by a big majority? The one that was against Colbert's sister.
Okay, yeah.
I thought that was so shameful. It was so embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because the constituents wanted them.
Yep.
But didn't make it right.
That's
but there
correct.
He is.
Yeah, well, I also have bizarre theories about democracy. and how it doesn't always work.
Oh, no. This is a complex issue. And I also agree with you that we should allow for different political groups that do not kill each other, that can be rational and clear thinking.
That's absolutely.
Say, you do that and you get your group to support that, and we need to support what we believe in. And that's real democracy,
well,
if you really want that.
I agree with
possible.
You. I agree with you. And I
okay,
will say
I
one thing. The one thing that I want, the one thing that I want everybody to agree on, the one political thing and artistic thing that I believe everybody should agree on is that this radio station is special and important and must survive.
Oh, no question.
And as long as you agree
and
with
we're
that.
Historic. The magnificent radio station.
Yeah. And as long as we agree with that one basic premise, then the rest of it is mutable. It's
thanks.
Oh, thank you. Have a wonderful night. What a wonderful call. Thank you so much. Good to hear from other people. If you'd like to call and talk on the air, the telephone number is area code 212-650-5782. And the number to call and pledge to keep this radio station going is 516-620-3602. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Hello. Hi. How are you? Good morning.
I'm well.
Good evening.
Yes. Hello. Good between times.
It'd be good to talk about science fiction for a change.
Okay, good.
Yeah, okay. Well, a lot of times what I do is go to Wikipedia, check the deaths, the obituaries, and then, you know, New York Times as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw, you know, recently Andrew J. Offutt. Remember some months ago I saw Harry Harrison, stuff like that. And now Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah. Yeah, and Andy Offutt, by the way, was a fellow who I hadn't seen him in 20 years, but at a time I used to run into him at conventions a lot, and I really loved him. He was such a sweet guy. I met Harry Harrison only once, but he was a hoot.
Yeah, they're very, very interesting characters, and their work, I hope that a lot of their work can stay in print, you know, being mid-list authors and that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, on Amazon, you could find stuff. Things are not always in print. And when I go to the science fiction section today in a bookstore, you know, like Barnes & Noble or whatever, there's a lot of mostly the people I never heard of. So people are getting published, people I never heard of. And it's funny, the artwork on the covers
is
more photographic than paintings.
On some of them, it depends. On fantasy literature, there's still a little bit of that Frank Frazetta-like imaginative work. But
yeah, I know Boris Vallejo and Ted Naismith are still around. You know, Darryl K. Sweet passed away.
Yes. So, yes.
That's a big one. That's a very big loss.
Yeah.
The publishing world to have that. And all that, you know, and with Ray Harryhausen, I'm like, well, I guess I would ask you, what do you think was your favorite character?
Oh.
Of all the characters, of all his sculptures.
Oh, geez. Okay, here, I'm going to throw a bizarre one at you. I loved the owl, the jeweled owl in, the Harry Hamlin movie that got remade. I'm blanking on the title.
In Clash?
Yes, Clash of the Titans.
Right.
I love that owl for no particular reason other than, well, the reason that, you know, he made it. It was a fun, cute character, and I thought, and because it was mechanical, the fact that it was stop motion sort of worked in its favor.
Right.
So if I had
even
to,
though, you know, even like Star Wars by 1977, there still was some more stop motion going on even in that film.
Oh yeah, I mean there's still a certain amount of stop motion used today. There was stop motion in Avatar. And rotoscoping, of course, which has nothing to do with stop motion, but is an even or an equally old technology, is very much alive today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess one of my favorite characters is probably from Jason the Argonaut. So I like that one a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the bronze statue of Talos.
Oh, that's a classic.
Scary.
Yeah.
When he's kneeling down on his like pedestal, and then like when Hercules and Hylas come outside, stealing stuff, whatever, he turns his head and stares at them. Oh my God, if that happened to me, I'd be crap in my pants to see a statue staring at me.
Okay.
And he's going to get up and chase me. Oh my God.
Yeah, that would be what they. In England, the Doctor Who moments, they would say, it's time to run behind the sofa.
Really?
It really is. Harryhausen, you know, he didn't create stop motion animation. What he did was he made it high art.
Mm-hmm.
And he and, of course, Charles Schneer, who he was working with, they created a kind of classy, cheap cinema that was a genre unto itself, and it wasn't as bad as the Hercules movies. But it was still in its way a little bit cheesy, but you've just got to love the Sinbad movie in which the bad guy is Tom Baker sneering and smiling throughout the film and stuff like that. And they were a genre unto themselves. And you take a look at what they do now with this Clash of the Titans series and you say, no, I'm sorry, you folks just don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And Harryhausen was a class act. He was a fun person, and he wanted to have fun, and he did it well. And I really feel with the passing of Bradbury and Harryhausen and Forry Ackerman that we have lost something, that an era has passed.
I think with all three of them, they were pretty close in age, and they've all pretty much gone around within the last 3 years.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And they lived within blocks of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, literally, they did. They're all in the same section of L.A.
They got into their 90s. They had full lives. They were living in retirement and doing nicely. And then I think the one I'm worried about next probably is Holland Ellison. He's going to be 80.
Holland has been. He's going to hear this, so I'm not going to hear the end of it. But he calls me every couple of years or so to rip my lungs out anyway or tear me a new one is his preferred thing. Harlan has been dying for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that he continues dying for another 30 years. But he has been confined to his bed for a long time. He was on the program last fall by phone. And, mm-hmm. yeah, I have to say what scared me is that he was conciliatory and sweet to me.
Mm-hmm.
And in his case, that's a danger sign.
Oh, boy.
He has always been... I've always been scared by him, and I finally figured out why, is because I was always in awe of him. And if you give as good as he gave himself, if he would verbally do something to you, and you gave it back to him, you were the best of friends. But if he mm-hmm. would, verbally abuse you and you go, oh, my, then it was like he didn't have respect for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think, but he did some utterly wonderful things for me but he scared the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Scares the hell out of me, even today.
It would be really funny if the writers of the Big Bang Theory called him up and said, invited him to come on the show, and he could just act, just be himself, acerbic as ever, with the cast, the four guys from Big Bang Theory at a convention or something. And that'd be hilarious.
Yeah, that would be, but they'd have to hold it around his bed at this point. He's pretty well bedridden. When I recorded that interview with him last year, we did have to time it according to what time of day he took his meds. So, but during that interview, a lot of those sharp teeth still showed through.
Yeah.
And,
well, you know, still around is Jack Vance, I believe, is 95, believe it or not.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Frederick Pohl is still around.
Thank God, Fred. Yeah, Fred was, when he lived in New York, he was a frequent visitor here. Mm-hmm. And he is a wonderful guy. I've not seen him in, I guess, about 8 or 9 years mm-hmm. because he doesn't travel to conventions anymore. He has settled down, I believe, at this point in Chicago.
Hmm.
So
I thought he was maybe still in Red Bank, New Jersey.
No, he left there, like 15 years ago.
Oh. I figured he'd be near the comic book store that Kevin Smith owns.
Yeah, well, one would think. But no, he moved out of the New York area. If he lived anywhere near there, he'd be on this show, or I'd be driving to him if needs be and all that. But no, he's not traveling as much. He moved to Chicago and he settled down there and he's very happy there.
Well,
and bless him, he should be about 95.
Yeah, so he's still up there. We also still have Larry Niven and Jerry Pornell.
Oh, yeah.
In their 60s, maybe, or 70, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're both older than me, and God help me, I'm nearing 60.
Mm.
Before the end of this year, I'll be 60. I can't believe it.
I'm 53 myself.
Yeah.
So I'm part of the late baby boom. I always go by Pete Townsend. You know, that's the way I look at it. Pete Townsend was born, today was VE Day. Pete Townsend was born May 19, 1945. He's the real baby boomer.
Yeah, literally, yes.
Go by him.
Yeah, the beginning of the boom.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and you and I are closer to the end of the boom, yeah.
Right, and Lennon is 1940, Bob Dylan's 1941, I think Woody Allen's 1935. I'm trying to figure it out. The way all these people are, Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead, he's I think he's 72.
Yeah.
And very healthy. that Bob Weir recently took a fall.
Oh, did he really?
Down on stage.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear, yeah.
He had a shoulder sprain, and he completed a song, and then he had to go backstage. He couldn't complete the tour or the rest of the concert.
He did a BAI benefit once.
Yeah, so he needs a doc. He's okay. He needs a doctor to look after him.
I'm glad to hear that. Met the man once. I had one day, I was a rock impresario for WBAI. And Bobby Weir was a part of that, with Jorma Kaukinen, no less.
Jorma's so good, yeah.
Oh, he's great. He's amazing. I was more of a Jefferson Airplane fan than a Deadhead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a good science fiction song by them. Have you seen The Sauces?
Oh, yeah.
I like that. I've been learning it. I think I'll play it with the capo on the third fret.
Okay.
Good song. Have you seen The Sauces?
Well, that's all part of a concept album.
Yeah, from Paul Kantner's head, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All the songs,
and that's a starship. That's vocals. Not the airplane.
Yeah. Well, it became the Jefferson Starship.
Well, yeah, they're different personnel between the two. You have to remember that. There were changes over the years, and by the time Starship had moved on, there was a, Marty Balin wasn't there. So, they were a different concept band. They were a different thing. You still had, and for me, though, it was always about Grace Slick.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
okay.
So we should probably...
Be careful going home tonight, because I know you're way uptown.
Yes, way uptown, but I was too tired tonight, so I did not drive in.
Okay, be careful.
Okay, I'll do that.
Look around, make sure no shady characters, on the street. So.
This, let me tell you something. This part of Harlem is probably safer than it was at 120 Wall Street. Mm. We're on campus here.
Oh, good.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hello. No, you're not. You're a dial tone. Our phone system is strange. I believe it rings like 6 times and then goes into voicemail. So if that happens, just call back. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello again, James. And at the risk of defending our neighborhood, it's not bad up here. It really isn't.
That's what I just said.
Oh, okay. Just a quick thing on Harryhausen. Because of certain films he made, and I have, what my predilections are in literature, I have to say that one of the best films he ever did, I liked Jason and the Argonauts. Sinbad, okay. Although I think the Sinbad, the seventh or the last...
Let's be quick. You've had a lot of airtime this morning.
Three Worlds of Gulliver.
Eh.
No, until the Ted Danson TV movie, I think that was the best one made.
That still doesn't make it good.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, telephone number to pledge to WBAI, which is what this is all about, is the continued existence of this radio station, is area code 516-620-3602. I am asking people, for the sake of remembering the days of WBAI, to pledge what used to be the normal subscription rate, $45. And that comes near to the number of years that I've been working here. I've been working here a little over 46 years at this point, starting at the age of 13, as a an answerer of telephones during fundraising drives. Right now we're outsourcing that. I understand we're trying to bring that back in-house. But right now, it's outsourced at area code 516-620-3602, and I do hope that you call that number and pledge. And also, I'm willing to take calls on a variety of topics, including the history of WBAI, and, of course, as always, science fiction and fantasy literature, at 212-650-5782. I wish I knew the system. There is a way of finding out whether people have pledged and how much they have pledged and all that, but I don't really know what it is. So I have to go on faith on this, but if I feel like we're going well and earning some money, we may even play a little radio drama or something this morning. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello,
you're on the air.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, turn on your radio. We're on delay.
Oh, okay. I'd like to talk about science fiction. As far as science fiction being the, how can I say, the prophet of where we're living at today, from a society we're living in, was it previously seen back in the days gone by.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to hang up and let you elaborate on
that. Well, wait. Don't hang up. It's dialogue.
Huh?
Don't hang up.
Okay.
No, we need dialogue. Because, first of all, I would contend that the purpose of science fiction is not to provide prophecy. The purpose of science fiction is to take a look of where we are today by extrapolating into the future. So it's not a question of prediction. It's a question of observation.
Okay.
For, you know, the novel 1984 by George Orwell was about the year 1948. You know, with the exception of a very few books that were really, you know, scientific kinds of things, and we're talking here the 1920s, science fiction was not about, let us tell you about the mystery of the future. It wasn't a question of prophecy. It does deal with the idea of if what's going on now continues to go on, such and such will happen. But that's not prophecy. That's reflection.
Now, my question to you is, are we living in science fiction? Are we actually living our science fiction? Otherwise, we've written a script that would be science fiction to one who, let's say, would be considered, let's say, passé or let's say futuristic, or however you may put it.
The question is, how are you defining science fiction?
About our situation today with the fracking and the global warming and the ice caps melting, would that be considered a science fiction?
No. No, that's merely reality. The global warming has been going on for for a lot longer than the genre of science fiction has existed. What science fiction does is it says if we accelerate global warming and things go too far and we don't prepare for it, this is what will happen. Global warming is a natural thing. The problem is that because of industrialization, we have accelerated global warming.
I see.
But, you know, we've come out of an ice age not that long ago. And by saying not that long ago, you know, 5,000 years ago, which in geological terms is nothing, is nothing. So global warming is something that should be happening. The problem is it's happening too fast. So is that science fiction? No, that's science.
I see. So basically, do a lot of people get this, you know, like, based on what I'm telling you, a lot of people, like, see us living into a science fiction type of situation, you know, or do they just say, well, this is the norm, you know, like, oh, it would it be, well, how, if you were to write a book on this, it would be considered the norm, as you, I guess, as you're saying.
Yeah, well, A, I can't write, but B, it's really a question of what you define as science fiction. Science fiction isn't necessarily about the future. It's usually about the present.
Mm.
You know, and it's not the job of science fiction to be prophecy. That's not the purpose of it. It's about what, in the case of the writings of, say, Philip K. Dick, he was asking, what is the human condition? What are the different, in the case of Samuel R. Delaney, also, what is the human condition? A masterpiece such as Dahlgren is simply taking a look at a surrealistic world, but it's very much writing about people today. So science fiction is not about in the year 2150 people are going to be flying in air cars. That's not the point. If we were to believe science fiction, when I started reading science fiction in the early 1960s, I could tell you that by the year 2000, we'd be living on Mars. You see what I'm getting at?
So basically, we, you know, I'm looking at science fiction, looking at, let's say, like the old writers who've written about the, you know, well, written about, let's say, the submarine. They seen the individual in the big glass bubble and went down under the water, and now we have the submarine that is like, otherwise it's like a prophecy type situation of technology.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is some of that, but, you know, the first person who was writing that kind of thing was Jules Verne. And by the time Jules Verne was writing, submarines existed. There were submarines in the Civil War. The Monitor and the Merrimack, remember that? He was writing about submarines after they already existed. Now, a lot of what he wrote, the point of Jules Verne's literature absolutely was adventure around the world in 80 days or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is still about a person who is so sick of war that he takes it into his own hands. It's still about humanity, and it's about the times that Jules Verne was living in and taking a look at all the wars that were going on at that time. He did a lot of adventure, and through scientific romance, which is what it would have been called at that time, into it. But he was not trying to predict anything any more than H.G. Wells was trying to predict time travel. These are literary devices, and these are people who are using literary devices in order to tell a tale that if you used simply ordinary or mainstream fiction, you wouldn't be able to tell the tale the same way. In fact, it would be impossible to tell the story of, for example, when you think of the time machine, what's important are the Eloi, which are, you know, a kind of angel. It's what the word actually means, versus the Morlocks, the users versus the used. And
now,
it's,
the time machine, now, I just want to ask you, the time machine, is that the one of the Doctor Who stories?
No, it's a novel by H.G. Wells written in the 19th century.
There was a Doctor Who.
Doctor Who is a time lord.
He was always into something.
No, there's no soldiers. The Doctor Who is a Time Lord who goes back and forth in time and space.
Oh, okay.
That's a TV series about to have its 50th anniversary later this year. Time Machine was a novel written in the 19th century by H.G. Wells.
Okay. All right.
Okay?
All right. Great. 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 One last thing. There was a lot of books. There was a lot of science fictions about traveling to Mars. I noticed that Mars has always been a big hit for science fiction.
Right.
Your opinion about Mars. What make Mars so romantic to the science fiction writer?
Well, it's the closest planet to us, next to the moon. And we have always known that the moon could not sustain life. But there were any number of reasons to believe in the 19th century that Mars either had life at one time or could even at that time be supporting life. And now there's reason to believe that there is proof that there was some kind of microbial life on Mars. So the fact that there could be, or could have been rather, life on Mars makes it very romantic. And it's our neighbor.
You know, the way you're putting it now is like there could have been life on Mars before there was life on Earth.
Yes. That is what NASA currently believes. Or at least they are trying to find, they're trying to find proof of water having existed there.
Don't chase me off the air, but don't chase me off the air.
I'm sorry?
We all heard about the Bible, and you have the part where it says the creation of heaven and earth. Now, here it comes. I believe the humanist and the Christian shaking hands on something that even though they don't agree on about religion, they're shaking in agreement about something. The Big Bang. I'm giving my spin on it.
Well, I'm gonna be a little.
The Big Bang happened, and the rocks flew. Now you got 9 planets circling around this terrific lava pool called the Sun, and the heavens are actually the solar system. And the Earth, and you have the creation of these different aspects of time and God. I'm going to get chased again. God is an alien. I know you're listening, shaking the head.
This is a conception that the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick often proposed.
And man denounced aliens. Okay, if you've seen the alien come down from the sky, you're gonna say, "Wow, this thing, what is this? What is this thing?" It's not pleasant looking, you know. But the whole thing is that man has made it his business to say anything that doesn't look like me is a monster.
Right.
So, how can we...
We even do that to other humans who don't look like other humans.
I embrace you when we're going to say to the universe, you're a monster. You understand where I'm going with this?
Yes.
And I'm gonna let you have your opinion on this because you're a very knowledgeable person.
Well, I would start by saying that I'm not one of those people that believe that faith and science are at odds with each other. I think that science is a form of faith. I believe that there are many scientists today, although they are in the minority, who don't buy the Big Bang theory. That Fred Hoyle, who was a bit of a genius and an eccentric one, and a great scientist and a great science fiction writer. He is the man who coined the term the Big Bang Theory, and what few people remember is that he coined it in derision. He said to people, "What, you really think that the universe was created in some kind of a Big Bang?" And he was being sarcastic when he said that. And that's how the term the Big Bang Theory came about. So Hoyle believed in something that was called the solid state theory and had a different reason to believe why planets are moving away from each other. Now, if you take all that, and what you have to remember that there's a lot more to the universe than just the universe. There is very good reason to believe that the universe, you know, there is such a thing as dark matter. There is such a thing as space between planets and things like that. And therefore, there is more in heaven and earth than can be dreamt of in our philosophy. So we don't really begin to understand science. And to quote a great science fiction writer, Arthur C. Clarke, magic is science that we do not yet understand. So where do these things intersect? That, in fact, is part of the purpose of science fiction and fantasy, to find the intersection between the known and the unknown. How's that for an answer? Okay, I guess we have lost our caller. But, well, we're also losing me because Lister is here with Burn Baby Burn Clapper, and he's going to be taking over these airwaves. And I don't know what the thon schedule is. As far as I know, I will be on next week with Hour of the Wolf. But whether I am or not, visit the website, OurWolf.com, HOURWOLF, and also visit me on Facebook. There's an Hour of the Wolf group, and join that and join discussion there. And in the meantime, support WBAI, because this kind of program can exist nowhere else. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expression. piece of cloth. That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They said that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
same old story. Everyone singing the same old song. Between the millions made and the millions suffering, I know that something has gone wrong. Whoa! I bet my clear cut the land and the factories come in to stay. And then my bomb the place if something don't go their way. From the assembly lines, I hear the children cry. Everyone's working for the house. Is it my jaded imagination? Boy, everyone's working for the house. Or am I asking too many questions? To whom does the house belong? Ooh, yeah. To whom does the house belong? I'm asking you, to whom does the house belong? It's always up and down, like a roller coaster. All they can do is hold on tight. Boy, they're thinking for themselves. The rules of competition make it hard to do what's right. Yeah, or will they ever see that the fate of the world is won? And stop the dirty tricks, let the people overcome. The future's looking strange, without some real change. Everyone's working for the house. Oh yeah. Is it my jaded imagination?